The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack from the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974, and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return to the June 2020 edition of Our State magazine. Celebrating North Carolina, of course. The theme this month has been Topsail Island and various things related to the islands, like the return of the sea turtles and Pier Steiner Delights. Tell you what happened last week. I thought I could get through the article by Drew Perry, my favorite writer for Our State. I only got partway through when the music came up, but I said, oh, I have to abandon it. So let me start again so that you can enjoy all of what Drew writes. Time stands still. On the coast, change is a way of life. But for a father and his young sons, a recent trip to an ocean pier turned out to be a halcyon day and a golden memory by Drew Perry. When all this is over, my boys asked me, can we go back to Topsail and eat burgers? It took me a moment to answer them. We were then 3 weeks into quarantine, the rhythms of our lives so utterly altered as to render even the days of the week mostly meaningless. But when I caught my breath, I said, of course we can. We have to, in fact. A brief bit of history. Beach-wise, I'm a bucket of bad beer guy. Fried shrimp. I'm an out-of-towner. I'm the vacationer who tries to leave only footprints and tries to keep his kids from leaving those footprints in the dunes. So when a friend asked, I'm not even sure why, if I'd ever had a pier burger, I said, a what? Who eats a burger at the beach? What even is such a thing? We day-tripped it, the boys and I. We'd been having a really hard week, me yelling at the kids for everything and nothing, and them yelling right back, and I wanted to jolt us out of wherever we were. We drove 3 hours each way to have 2 hours barefoot on the beach on a day that wanted hoodies and hats, and I took them alone, my wife catching me in the driveway saying, are you sure you don't want company? It was a recipe for calamity. But somehow we had a quiet ride of reading and podcasts and no screens at all. And we came over the bridge and saw the ocean and I don't know what happened or how it happened. We landed at the Seaview Fishing Pier, whose namesake restaurant is housed in a country singer's former recording studio, as evidenced by the 20-foot-long guitar shingled into the side of the building. We ordered at the counter. We sat at one of the 15 or so blue booths. We watched the televisions on the wall cycle through photos of people holding up their catches, spot and mackerel mostly. Our food came in a paper boat lined with waxed paper, hamburgers for the boys, and a glorious double cheeseburger for me, a $7 steel that was the size of my face and might have weighed a pound. These places dot the coast. Tiny pier diners for fishermen who have little time or patience for seafood dives, piping karaoke ballads through speakers hung from fake fishing nets. I'd never been in one. Oh, I never thought to be in one. We loved it. The burger was unfussy and delicious. And I let the boys drink fountain sodas. And we ate until we were sad and happy at the same time. afterward. We paid our dollar to walk on the pier, and then left our shoes on the deck and went down to the beach where the kids played in the frigid water. And I managed somehow not to ask them to be careful, not to tell them not to get wet. They managed to say things like please and thank you. It was a stolen afternoon, and the magic of it was that we knew it somehow, all three of us, knew to enjoy it, knew to hug each other and dig our toes into the sand there on the edge of the state and the world. We brought back shells, and my 9-year-old made us keep one in our rooms. Mine's on my bedside table. A palm-sized orange clamshell that I'd like to pick up and remind myself to be still and of the promise I've made them, which is not only that we'll go back, but also that Topsail will be the first place we'll go. We never go back to that same afternoon, I know, but we'll go back and see what versions of ourselves we find when this is all over, we go eat burgers one way or another. Now, if you want to go to the piers, you can download our state's comprehensive guide to North Carolina piers for fishing fun and excellent burgers at ourstate.com/piers. And now, The Rum Diary. Tall tales of shipwrecks and smugglers on the Outer Banks inspired four young entrepreneurs to revive a storied tradition. Their Manteo distillery combines history and legend into a potent new concoction. Picture here of four young men, one of them quite hirsute, pretty heavy beard that just kind of molds right into his brown curly hair at the top. Oh, a couple of them sitting on barrels, too. It's hard to find many people along the Outer Banks who use the word booze yacht anymore. It sounds sort of like booze shot, and it helps to have a little booze in you when you try to get the slur in the middle just right. It used to be slang for have a good time. At least, that's what they claim at Outer Banks Distilling in Manteo, the home of Kill Devil Rum. When you step up to the bar for a tasting or to order a cocktail, you are surrounded in the mystique of rum's history up and down the Outer Banks. There are maps of shipwrecks, historical pictures, and salvaged items like a big ship's wheel. And there's a sign explaining the definition of booyat, term that comes from the Prohibition era when smugglers aboard pleasure craft or booze yachts sometimes dumped illegal cargo that washed ashore. Co-owner Scott Smith admits, though, that an awful lot of what you hear about liquor on the Outer Banks may be a bit embellished. There's a lot of legend that gets wrapped around myth, he says. The Outer Banks were made for legends and tales, especially when you mix in liquor, rum and pirates, remote beaches, marshes, and fog-shrouded inlets that were perfect for hiding treasure, and later Prohibition-era contraband. According to Smith, Kill Devil Hills was even named for an old Caribbean version of rum created from wild yeast and the molasses left over from making sugar. Enslaved West Africans on sugar plantations used it medicinally, saying it killed the devil inside, the devil being bacterial contamination. When people started to distill rum, making it a little, okay, a lot easier to drink, they also figured out that it wouldn't spoil on long voyages the way water did. So ships started keeping barrels of rum on board for the crew. Since plenty of those ships wrecked on the jagged coast of what eventually became North Carolina, and since barrels float, locals along the coast like to grab the barrels from wrecks and hide them in the dunes. Anywhere you have history of the sea, you're having rum, Smith says. Rum was the common man's drink. Many old families along the Outer Banks have passed down stories of ancestors who floated ashore on, and sometimes in, barrels from shipwrecks. And notices of salvage auctions give a good idea of what other kinds of things floated ashore. One auction notice from 1812 included the cargo from the wreck of a schooner called Thetis. 14 hogshead of rum, some apple brandy, wine, cider, butter, cheese, tea, powder, dry goods, and many other small articles. All of that was a long time ago, though. Now Smith and his three partners, Kelly Bray, Matt Newsom, and Adam Ball, are putting everything they have into bringing rum-making back to the Outer Banks. This time, it's legal. The Outer Banks has always been a place to scratch out a living any way you could, from fishing to logging. Isolated from the mainland, people from Duck down to Ocracoke did for themselves, and I liked it that way. If they didn't salvage rum from a wrecked ship, they made moonshine out of whatever they had. Philip Howard, owner of the Village Craftsman, a popular art and craft shop in the town of Ocracoke, is descended from one of the early families. People in Ocracoke were churchgoers, he says, but plenty of them still like to take a drink. People used to say if you could leave a fifth of whiskey holding down a $100 bill in the hood of your car, Howard says, when you came back, the fifth would be gone, and it'd be a rock holding down the $100 bill. Local folks made meal wine. Cornmeal, water, yeast, sugar, and any kind of dried fruit like raisins. They'd mix it in jars and hide it in the woods to steep for a couple of weeks until the yeast turned the sugar into alcohol. Howard says that the difference between a mainlander and a native Ocracoker was that if a rat got into the meal wine, the mainlander would throw it away. The Ocracoker would wring out the rat and keep the wine. Farther north on Roanoke Island, people still talk about the ghost town of Buffalo City, once located across the marshes from Manteo on a rail line. Founded as a logging town by the Buffalo Timber Company in the late 1800s, it was a thriving place with a hotel and post office. Farther north on Roanoke Island, people still talk about the ghost town of Buffalo City, once located across the marshes from Manteo on a rail line. Founded as a logging town by the Buffalo Timber Company in the late 1800s, it was a thriving place with a hotel and post office. By the 1920s, logging was slowing down just as Prohibition arrived. So people in Buffalo City built stills using rye to make whiskey that quickly earned a good reputation. Buffalo City was abandoned in the 1950s, and the land was eventually bought by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to create the Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. Only a few traces of the village, including some of the main tracks, remain. There's a black and white photo on this page, obviously a real oldie. It shows some brown shingled buildings with wooden slat fences around them, and a dirt road and a bit of a railroad track coming up in front of some of the buildings. And it looks like there's a flatbed trailer there. It might be a person standing on the edge of that trailer. Can't really tell at this distance. It says Prohibition arrived just as the logging camps of Buffalo City began closing in the 1920s. The village, across Croydon Sound from Manteo, became a moonshining hotspot supplying speakeasies across the eastern United States. When Scott Smith settles in for a drink at a local bar where tall windows overlook a peaceful late afternoon on Pamlico Sound, he orders a beer, not a cocktail. "I'm swimming in rum all day," he admits. A native of Newport News, Virginia, Smith has always been obsessed with archaeology. At Longwood University in Virginia, where he majored in communication studies with a history minor, he persuaded a professor to let him come along to dig on the island of Tortola in the British Virgin Islands. While he was there, he started learning about the Caribbean rum industry, a history that captured his imagination. After college in 2004, he moved up to the Outer Banks and ended up working at Outer Banks Brewing Station in Killdevil Hills. His co-workers were brewers Adam Ball and Kelly Bray and bartender Matt Newsom. Newsom and Bray both came of age on the Outer Banks, hearing about the history of illegal liquor in the area, and all four young men were ready to quit working for other people. They didn't want to start a brewery, though, because there was so many of them. "We were ready to jump ship and work for ourselves," Newsom said. Rum was a no-brainer. They originally planned to build in Killdevil Hills, but distilling requires good water, and Manteo was the only municipality in the area with a full water system. So they founded a 1946 brick building on Budley Street that was originally a furniture store and then a department store. It later housed the school board, but it had been abandoned for years. They all quit their brewery jobs in 2013 and started renovating the building with help from Bray's dad, Larry, a carpenter. It was a massive job. Original cypress beams were removed and used as door frames and woodwork. The distilling room floor was replaced and pine floors were refinished. They hauled out 20 tons of scrap and hauled in artifacts like the ship's wheel from the famous 1925 wreck of the schooner Irma. A wooden shelf displayed behind the tasting room bar is timber from a wreck that's been dated to 1652. It took 2 years to get the operation up and running, and the four men soon found themselves embraced by the local community. "The amount of support we had was unreal," Smith says. "Since their first batch of white rum in 2015, they've grown quickly, with five fermentation tanks making white, gold, and spiced rums. They aged their rums in used bourbon barrels from A. Smith Bowman Distillery in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and they now have a yearly series named for local shipwrecks. Their pecan rum is made with pecans from a 90-year-old grove in Mann's Harbor and honey from one cheese. After being soaked in rum, the pecans are dried, coated with sugar, and sold in the distillery shop. Our first batch is today, or first batch to today is night and day," Smith says. "We were so naive. We're both tourists and locals, though. Being able to buy rum made right there in Manteo is a long way from the days when what you had to drink depended on whether you could make it legally or what you could salvage from the sea. That was a time when everybody knew the word boujat from the local musician Ivy Scott's song commemorating a day when barrels of whiskey floated ashore from a boat loaded with contraband. Some would part with all they got, and some a little more, to see another time like that when the booze yacht ran ashore." Smith has found a lot of satisfaction in becoming a part of such a long history, and the people of the Outer Banks have embraced him. "I didn't have four generations buried here, but I have respect for the area," he says. "I felt like I'd come home." That was written by Kathleen Purvis, an award-winning food writer in Charlotte and the author of Distilling the South, a guide to Southern craft liquors and the people who make them. Now I'm going to read a series of short articles under the heading New Coastal Classics. An ice cream shop, a seafood restaurant, retro models, and more. These spots have established themselves as North Carolina's latest beloved beach destinations. Here is a picture of an absolutely delicious-looking dessert here. It looks like it's big enough for three people. It says, Celtic Creamery makes everything from scratch. Whipped cream, chocolate sauce, waffle cones, and hot, fresh mini donuts, that's what I see at the bottom, which serve as the base for sundaes like the Surfer's Special. Celtic Creamery in Carolina Beach. In a seaside town in Ireland, some 3,500 miles from Carolina Beach, Jeff Hogan tasted the best ice cream he ever had. It was creamy and dense, with more butterfat and less air than the ice cream he was used to. He spent the next several years trying to convince the shop owner, Joanna McCarthy, to let him bring her recipe to the United States. She refused at first, but during his frequent visits to Ireland, their families grew close, and finally, McCarthy told him, "There's not a family I'd rather be in business with than yours." Hogan spent weeks with McCarthy on both sides of the Atlantic learning her recipes. Together, they traveled 800 miles around North and South Carolina looking for the best ingredients. The translation wasn't exact. In the U.S., for example, we don't have Kinder Bueno, a European chocolate bar with a hazelnut filling. So the pair substituted Heath Bar, and McCarthy's popular Kinder Bueno flavor became Heavenly Heath instead. And Hogan knew that for a North Carolina audience, they had to come up with recipes for butter pecan, birthday cake, and banana pudding, flavors you won't find in Ireland. Celtic Creamery opened in May of 2018, but at the end of that summer season, Hurricane Florence blew through and peeled off the shop's roof. Hogan spent the next 7 months rebuilding, and in April 2019, Celtic Creamery reopened, once again serving a taste of Ireland on Carolina's shores. They're located at 20 North Park Boulevard in Carolina Beach. Mark Bassnight Bridge, Oregon Inlet. The old Herbert C. Bonner Bridge that connected the northern Outer Banks to Hatteras Island was supposed to last 30 years. It stuck around for 56. Toward the end of its life, lanes were frequently closed for construction. Traffic was often backed up. In December 2013, the bridge was shut down for nearly 2 weeks because inspectors discovered that too much sand had washed away from around the pilings. On a scale of 1 to 100, the North Carolina Department of Transportation once rated the bridge's condition a 2. There were a lot of options on the table to replace it, including a 17-mile bridge that would bypass Pea Island and connect directly to Redanth. Another idea? No bridge. Just ferries to reach Avon, Buxton, Hatteras Village, and so on. Ultimately, the state built a new bridge right next to the old one, a taller, sleeker structure meant to carry some 2.5 million annual visitors to and from Hatteras Island. In February 2019, the new Mark Bassnight Bridge finally opened. The 90-foot-tall bridge sits on pilings driven 140 feet into the seabed, allowing the sand to do more of what it does naturally. It's a structural marvel designed to withstand hurricanes and last 100 years, and it's won architectural design awards. To Beth Midget, a real estate agent in Hatteras Village, the new bridge seems magical, like a portal to another world. It's where you leave the real world behind and go to this world where we all live. Picture of it here. It says, after the new Bassnight Bridge on the left opened, sections of the old Bonner Bridge were dismantled to create 4 reef sites offshore. This was taken at a time where they were still working on the tall bridge, and the smaller bridge is still in place. You can see it rises up in the middle to allow a passageway for boats at one point. The new bridge has many such passageways, all of which are higher. Boro Low Country Kitchen in Swansboro. Boro Low Country Kitchen occupies prime waterfront space in this small fishing town that serves as a gateway from to the Crystal Coast. About 150 yards from the restaurant's dock is the ka-chunk, ka-chunk of beach traffic driving over the bridge to Cedar Point. Boro's walk-up window slides open like a fast food drive-thru, but don't expect a burger and fries. This joint specialty is seafood boiled with corn, sausage, and potatoes in a secret concoction of spices, no Old Bay allowed, and served steaming hot on aluminum platters. The Low Country Boil was a real Hail Mary, says Randy Swanson, who opened the restaurant last year. He also owns the Ice House restaurant, which has closed temporarily due to damage from Hurricane Florence. It wasn't really being done around here. Fortunately, it's really taken off. Standing at the window near an old statue of a jolly pirate, you'll order from a folded paper menu. Should you get lobster, snow crab, shrimp, and mussels? or maybe blue crab and clams. Whatever you decide, a cold beer will likely come in handy. Then you take your tray and beer back to one of the long, high-top tables on the deck, grab a shell cracker, and savor the taste of the sea. Borough Low Country Kitchen is at 103 Moore Street in Swansboro. And how about Stinson Ranch in Nag's Head? Billy Stinson was devastated when in 2011 Hurricane Irene swallowed up the beloved early 1900s cottage in Nag's Head that his family had owned for nearly half a century. Stinson's ranch was a beauty, perched on pilings surrounded by the sloshing waters of Roanoke Sound and attached to the shoreline by a 55-foot-long pier. It had dramatic views of sound and sky, of seagulls and sailboats, and a canvas of stars at night. The inside was cozy and eclectic, a reflection of the retired Greenville art teacher's creative spirit. On summer evenings, Billy, his wife Sandra, and their two daughters would play acoustic guitars and sing or create art together against a backdrop of warm, brown, beadboard walls and ceilings. It had a personality, Billy lamented to a local news site after Irene destroyed the place. It sure did. Then a miracle happened. A neighbor who owned a construction company and friends from Greenville and the Outer Banks banded together to help raise money to rebuild the iconic cottage, which is available as a rental. Construction was completed in 2013. Now secured with salt-resistant stainless steel beams and brackets and sitting higher above the water than before, the new Stinson Ranch is a nearly exact replica of the old one, its creative spirit reborn. Stinson Ranch is at 521 West Soundside Road in Nag's Head. And finally, Palin's Alley in Elizabeth City. A block from the Pascatank River, alfresco diners in Palin's Alley linger over fried green tomatoes and reconnect over Daydreamer Blonde Ale. The scene is a far cry from how it looked a few years ago when Jim Nye opened Hoppin' John's on the corner of Palin's Alley and Colonial Avenue in 2016. The area was overgrown and neglected. He and his partner Rose cleaned it up and carved out a place for bistro-style seating. When we opened Hoppin' John's, the available alley space cried out for plants, Rose said. The next year, Thomas and Tabitha Reese opened Ghost Harbor Brewing Company in a former stable and livery. And then in 2018, lifelong Elizabeth City residents Jan and Scott Mills and their son Michael opened the Mills Downtown Bistro. When I was growing up, it was exciting to come downtown, and then it just died, Jan says. But now I stand here and see it coming back. It makes me so happy. Well, I'm not happy. We run out of time for today's episode of Our State. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions, comments? Call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.